And I'm trucking on, I'm trucking on. Well, I'll move her on down the line. Another time will do me fine. I'm trucking on.
Howdy, friends, and welcome to Trucking On. I'm your host, Ward Richmond. I really appreciate you tuning in today, and I hope you enjoy the show. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Trucking On. I'm really pumped about today's episode that I just recorded with George Billingsley. George is head of industrial development for the Billingsley Company right here in Dallas, Texas. And he and I have worked on numerous deals together over the years, but more importantly, we've become very good friends. And George is one of my favorite conversationalists. And whenever we have a phone call that's work-related, it typically turns into about a 30-minute call talking about life. And they're some of my favorite calls of all time. And one of those calls was taking place this week. And I had the great idea to invite George on the podcast. This is his first time to do a podcast. So I'm quite honored that he chose to do it with me, and I'm very thankful for getting to sit down with him. We literally talked on the phone yesterday, and then he invited me over to his house today to record this. So love that. And we got right into it, and we cover all the things I like to cover. So sit back, relax, and here we go. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Trucking On. It's a pleasure to have you with us here today. And with me today is my good friend, business partner of over the years. We've worked on many of projects together. We've gotten the business at the same time, and we have become good friends through this process. I'm so excited to have you as, I think, the third guest on the podcast so far. George Billingsley, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ward. I'm honored to be here. This is my first podcast and happy to do it with a good friend.
Yes, sir. Love that it's your first podcast. I always find that you and I have incredible conversations whenever we hang out. And that's what was happening yesterday. We were talking about a deal and then we just started catching up on life. And I was like, dude, let's, instead of getting lunch, let's just do a podcast. So, I came over to your house today. Thanks for welcoming me and the show right into your home. We don't have video yet, but maybe in the future.
Happy to have you here. No, it's a bit more indulgent than lunch because presumably it's all about me today, but I'm happy to indulge.
I've loved this process because it puts me in more of an observant mode than I typically am, where I'm the one trying to like tell my story or, you know, being in sales and whatnot.
Right.
I have a tendency to do that a lot. So I get to sit back and listen. Yeah. So let's get into this. I came up with this first question. I modified it a little bit from the first episode, but I was talking with one of my business coaches and he's like, whenever you read an autobiography or something, like some of the most exciting parts of that story about anyone that's achieved something significant in their life is like what happened ages 12 to 22. I think those are really important years. And we don't have to get into like every detail of the things that happened, but really just if you can give us a feel for like, what were you like from that, you know, early like adolescence, getting into high school and then through college, and how, you know, what happened and what were your passions? What did you learn? And how do you feel like those years shaped the rest of your life?
No, I think it's a great question. Those are years that are so formative and developmental, but often overlooked. And, you know, I was very studious growing up. I was extremely studious. I was very focused on college. And I was a bit ineffectual, in elementary school and middle school. I was not hitting the marks, not a great student. And then I found this tutor named Tom Hansel, my freshman year of high school, who was very transformative and just helped me become a much better student. And that helped me to be, successful onward from there towards college. Yeah.
Where did you go to high school? Or all of them.
Yeah. So I did high school at Highland Park High School, enjoyed it there. And then, so I started at Parish Episcopal, Parish Day School at the time, went on to McCullough Middle School, and then Highland Park High School. And, but yeah, that was my focus. I was really just, you know, I was kind of raised that way to be very focused on school. I would say it was a bit to the neglect of my social development. I wasn't especially social. I had a few close friends who remain close friends. But that was just, I was very linear. I kind of had blinders on, and that was my whole kind of modus operandi. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
The tutor became one of your close friends.
Yeah. He was very helpful.
Did you work with a tutor all through high school?
You know, so he helped me all through high school, as well as a couple siblings of mine. I think all three of my siblings. And then you asked all the way through 22, so age 22. So
you got out of Highland Park, you graduated.
Yeah. So I went, and college was a tumultuous developmental time in my life. Ultimately, it worked for the good, but it was full of adversity. And so I went to Cornell University freshman year. And I know up in the Northeast, you went from Dallas up to the Northeast as well. I remember, yeah. But you kind of lasted longer than I did. So after one semester, it just wasn't a good fit for me. It's a wonderful school. It's an impressive school, but just a bad fit for me personally. And then I started to shift my gaze a bit and my emphasis. And instead of so much about academia, I shifted over to the social part of life and made my way to the University of Texas at Austin. Joined a fraternity that a bunch of my friends from high school were in. And
what fraternity?
Fiji.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was a Fiji down at Texas, and you know, and there's a lot of quality people down there. But you know, I was kind of throughout college, I was kind of in a searching state of mind, and ultimately, this seminal event for me was I became a Christian in college, and that was what I was looking for. I don't even think I always knew what I was looking for, but that seemed to be. You know, that really gave me a peace, a sense of orientation, and a stability in my life that I had been previously lacking. And that's proved to be foundational for me ever
faith
since.
Faith.
Yeah.
In general, right?
Faith in general. You know, I just felt, and I don't mean, I know this is predominantly a business podcast, so I don't want to.
It's really not. It's the opposite.
Okay.
So,
good.
Yeah, get into it.
For me, and I'm not attempting to proselytize or, you know, persuade anybody, but just my own personal journey. Was one where I had these various idols from, you know, as I mentioned, academia to, you know, social clubs and whatnot. And those are good institutions are good and well, but they just ultimately were not what I needed. And what I needed was some sort of orienting centrality in my life around faith. And I found that thankfully. Some close friends from high school were very encouraging to me throughout that whole journey. They were all Christians. And so I ended up transferring. I think you probably know this word, but I ended up transferring to this, you know, candidly lesser known school called Dallas Baptist University. Mm-hmm. Was a Christian studies major, so that was my entire focus, and continued with that linear state of mind. I really went all in, and I enjoyed it. And then I went from there on to graduate school at SMU for business school after that to kind of round out my education a little bit.
Yeah, that. So wait, did you grow up going to church?
You know, a little bit, but not a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my folks were not, how do I say it? They didn't really impose themselves.
They didn't force you to go to Sunday school and church. My parents forced me to go.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that necessarily worked for me either.
Right.
You know?
So we have some, you know, in our broader family, we have various perspectives and, but my folks were kind of, very much about kind of see what makes sense for you. And this is what ultimately resonated with me. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would ask about your family, but we're going to ask about your business here shortly.
Please.
And your family and your business are very
pretty
intertwined.
Pretty intertwined, exactly. I was at a school show for my son as recently as this morning and sat next to my mom/boss. So it's all intertwined.
That's right.
Yeah.
So you went to graduate school, got your MBA, and you got out there.
A Master of Science and Management.
Master of Science and Management.
Yeah.
So, and then Yeah, I was trying to think what I majored in at Brown. It's called Organizational Behavior and Management. So that. It's kind of the similar thing. OBM.
Yeah.
A lot of the football players majored in the OBM. Yeah.
Well, I think, I mean, understanding human behavior and EQ seems to be just pivotal in business success. I think even more than the technical skills most often. So that might have been
100%
prescient on your side to kind of get ahead of that. Yeah.
You know, yeah. And Brown was a very liberal arts school, so they didn't have an actual business program. That was the closest thing to it.
Gotcha.
And it was a lot of that, the more EQ side of things, yeah. And the entrepreneurial way of thinking, and right. less about the economics and accounting. You took those classes, but my favorite classes were the others, the less linear.
Exactly.
Things. So, then you got out of SMU and did you start working the family, business right after there? Let's talk 22 to current and kind of cover personal and,
meeting,
you know, Lindsay and the family and all of that. And then we dig into business next.
So I worked for my family from the get-go. I did 3 years on the multifamily side. And then I've done, I think it's 12 years now on the industrial side. I've been at the company for 15 years and counting. And so multifamily apartments was not a good fit for me. Kind of trial and error, for a number of reasons, but I was just drawn to, I'll frame it more positively. What drew me to industrial was the culture. You know, you're a friend. I have lots of friends in the industry. There's a lot of goodwill and a lot of quality people that, you know, a lot of repeat business. So I enjoyed the goodwill and the camaraderie. I love that the buildings, warehouses are durable and they age well. You know, I mean, so many buildings, just like apartments, for example, get beat up bad, partially because psychologically people are just cognizant that they're not going to be there very long. And so so they get pretty beat up pretty quickly. Warehouses tend to age well. They tend to be, you know, tolerate a fair amount of abuse. And even the older dilapidated buildings that are not quite as enticing tend to be at really central, fantastic locations because what was once tertiary is now central. And so for all those reasons, it's a great asset class that really tends to appreciate with time. And I just was drawn to the culture. I actually entered industrial before it was so much in vogue with the e-commerce trend, just because I just was drawn to it.
As did I. And I got into it in 2006. And then I feel like you and I started working together in probably 11 or 12.
That sounds
around
right.
There.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm older than you too. So, yeah. But yeah, it wasn't, e-commerce wasn't, it was happening, but nobody was talking about it. And, it was such a different world back then. And, the culture drew me to industrial. I leased office space for 2 years out of college.
That's right. Yeah.
And, then I took off and played in my band for a few years. And then when I decided to get back into commercial real estate, I had a few friends that did industrial and I just felt like it was, I felt like you could wear jeans to work
right.
and get away with it.
Right.
I love still the down to earth blue collar nature of so many of my clients, and a lot of CEOs of major companies actually started like working in warehouses at the beginning of their career. And I think to be a great CEO in that world, you have to know how everything works.
Yeah.
And the irony is that building a warehouse is probably the easiest thing to build from a real estate standpoint. But then what goes on inside of a warehouse, in my mind, is probably way more complex than what
exactly.
goes on inside of any other type of commercial property.
Exactly.
And what these, to go manage one of these companies that go inside the warehouse, there's so many moving parts and the engineers that put these plans together and,
right.
And have to think about how to move products, like basically in the macro from raw materials to manufacturing goods to then distributing these goods all around the world to the end customer. And that's just like, and once you can live in a state of ignorance forever and just walk into the grocery store and not think about how things get on the shelf. But once you see behind the curtain, it's I began to see the whole world differently. And
I love the simplicity, as you referenced, the simplicity of warehouses. I mean, they're just big boxes, and I think that lends itself to mastery. There's less complexity and therefore fewer moving pieces, and so there's less that can go wrong. And so I like to feel, you know, that sense of, you know, a heightened sense of control. There's always some things that can go wrong, but fewer variables. So I like that. They also tend to be somewhat austere very often. Warehouses, they're very simple and boxy and, you know, plain vanilla. And to me, that was more of an opportunity to distinguish ourselves because we can embellish with paint and stone and landscaping and such. And it's harder to distinguish, for example, in offices where there's, you know, beautiful office buildings every which way. And so I kind of like that dimension as well.
Yeah, so yeah. Your business, the Billingsley Company, you've now been there for 15-ish years. How long has the business been going? And then maybe we can go back even and go like talk about your grandfather.
Sure.
Who kind of started it. And that's Trammell Crowe. Like, I would say like one of the most legendary real estate just people in the world. But certainly here in Dallas. And I always like to remind you that he went to Woodrow Wilson High School.
That's right.
Where I went to high school.
I was aware of that. Yeah.
And he was always an avid supporter of Woodrow when I was there. And my mom always would brag about how she would like, you know, she would call on him to fundraise or something and he would write her a handwritten letter and like, but it was really cool. So I grew up knowing kind of the legend of Trammell Crowe. My dad was he's still in commercial real estate mm-hmm. business as well. So you hear about that growing up in Dallas and then you're, so you want to talk about like how he created this legacy and then your mom and dad have both gone on to
taking
like
it and
just
ran
taking
with it
to the next level. And I want to hear all of that.
So yeah, he was a very revered person. He has a stellar reputation. I think he was, you know, I don't want to brag too much, but I mean, I think he was more than a significant business person. I think he was like an altruistic person that really endeared himself to so many others. And, you know, unfortunately, I didn't know that firsthand in the sense that he had Alzheimer's for, I don't know, maybe a decade or something like that. And so as kind of I was coming of age at a level of consciousness where I could have relationships was give or take around the time that he was drifting away with Alzheimer's. So that was a sad reality. But, you know, throughout my life, so many folks have come up and said how much they enjoyed him and that they knew him and they had a positive working relationship. And so I can surmise from that that he was just beloved by so many, and that's really special. In fact, curiosity got the best of me one time, and I Googled him. I was thinking, he's a pretty well-known person. There's probably an interview out there somewhere, and I'm curious because I've been to 100 dinners with him probably, but I've never really seen him that conversant, so to speak. And sure enough, this guy, Brian Lamb on C-SPAN, had interviewed him for like a no commercials, like a pretty, I think it was a straight hour, fantastic interview. And I really got a lot out of that and could see why people were so drawn to him. And then I gave it to my mom, who in turn gave it to my grandmother. And apparently she watched it on repeat many times and really also kind of time traveled. And, you know, that was really special for her too. So, but he was a dear person. Also just was very engaged in politics and some other extracurriculars outside of business. So a little bit of a Renaissance man in that way. And then my mom is, you know, very much like my grandfather from everything I've heard. She has a tremendous work ethic, a real zeal and enthusiasm for life, an optimism that maybe is even a bit detached from, you know, pragmatism from time to time. Yeah. But I see that and he was known for that too, by the way. But I see that as a positive. And so they have a lot, I think those two have a lot in common. And she's, you know, she's a great mother. It's hard to balance family business dynamics. I think by my observation, most probably falter in some ways, you know. But I really commend her because she's been magnanimous and thoughtful and learned how to be the mother and the boss, which in some respects are almost contradictory roles simultaneously. And so I'm really appreciative of that.
And your mom is Lucy Billingsley.
Right.
So
right.
She started working right into the family business as well after college. Is that
right? That is correct. Went? Yeah. She went to UT Austin and then worked in Houston for a little bit, but made her way to the Dallas Market Center. She ran the Dallas Market Center for a while. I remember that vaguely in my early youth. And my dad was a partner at Trammell Crowe Company. So the two of them You know, it's her second marriage, but she married him, and then they started Billingsley Company. He really started it, and she joined shortly thereafter. That was, I can't tell you the exact year, but it was late 1970s.
Okay.
And it's, to your point, it's really, thankfully, it's prospered a lot. My dad has a great land acquisition acumen.
He's a legend in his own
right. He's very gifted at
land selection.
Land is really his passion.
And buying land at like amazing value as well.
So he's very good at that. And so that's really complimentary because he'll buy at scale most of the time, which gives a bit of a discount, but also creates a great canvas for the company at large. And then my mom has a different skill set. She likes to develop and manage. So she'll come and take that piece of land, figure out the allocation of utilization, and then just kind of get after it from a development standpoint.
And she loves, from what I've heard, and I've met her a couple times. I might have to, you know, send her our podcast and try to get
her
on this podcast
as
well. But she likes all of the details that you find in developing multifamily or offices and the interiors. And coincidentally, my brother-in-law works in construction
for
the Billingsley Company. Yeah. He just started a year ago, and I know he works in the multifamily division and just all of the detail. And just from talking to, you know, to him, like, I know, like, your mom still, she knows everything that's being
done. Very granular. She's very in the minutiae, and just, you know, for her, it's a calling. She loves her job. It's not laborious. I mean, she really enjoys it. And it was always that way growing up. I mean, she would do paperwork till, I don't know, 9 p.m. or something like that on the floor. So it's not really work to her. And so that makes her better at it, I think, because when you love something and you're that committed to it, you tend to be quite good at it. But it's just kind of involuntary. That's her passion. Yeah.
Okay. So back to George Billingsley.
Yeah. Let's go back to the matter at hand.
That's right. It's just such an interesting company story. Like most people don't have such like a long history and being in Dallas. And I think it's so cool. So you did the multifamily. I remember right when you started industrial, we met right away. You had a luncheon for us Colliers brokers, and that's where I met you the first time. And then you started with your first development project. So if you do you want to kind of talk about that, and then maybe talk about what you think differentiates you as you know, now the head of industrial for Billingsley Company versus maybe some of your competitors out there.
Sure. Yeah, so Mercer Business Park is the first development I've ever done. It was a tract of land, a couple hundred acres at the northwest corner of 635 and 35 that Henry bought at a really good price. And so that was a great canvas for me and a great way to start. And so we started just with one building there and then ultimately built six. And thankfully, they've all leased, they've all met or exceeded pro forma. I took a lot of pride knowing that we're long-term holders to try and, you know, really embellish and not cut corners. And especially because it's such a prominent location, it has such visibility, it'd be a shame to kind of like, you know, go cheap when it's such a fantastic location. And so that one's gone really well. Now it's six buildings, fully leased. Really, I got really long-term financing on it, 20 to 30-year debt. So it's been a big success story. And I've developed eight buildings now, and then I have an additional four that are under construction currently. So six of the eight, 75% are at that one location, and then the other two are at our Austin Ranch development.
Yeah. So one thing cool about Mercer is that you moved the whole flooring and kind of that flooring decor marble type business. And I put one of these tenants in there.
That's right.
The Stone Collection. And moved them from the other side of 635, the south. They were all on the south side of 635. I forgot. It's called like
Zodiac.
Zodiac or Tile Row or is that what they call it? Something like that.
I think so.
They were all next to each other in these old 1960s, 70s warehouses that potentially your grandpa might have built, some of them. And then they moved across to your product, which is brand new, state of the art. Still in the city of Dallas, is that right?
You know, so our property is in the city of Dallas and Farmers Branch.
Okay.
The line goes right through it, yeah.
I remember trying to find that spot for the Stone Collection. They wanted to be in Dallas so the designers would see it. And it's just, that was the only place where you could have a brand new warehouse to lease and be in the city of Dallas and still have close proximity to right. where all these designers are going. And that business is unique because they double as warehouses and showrooms.
Exactly.
Because you got to go look at these huge slabs of tile. And then, but there's just, I mean, I don't know how many tenants over there now, but I would assume.
A little over 20, I think. Yeah.
20
yeah.
different.
Yeah.
Well, 20 in that business or.
Oh, pardon me. No, 20 total, but I would say the, probably half of them are in home improvement broadly. And then, tile, and you know, marble and granite is probably the majority of that piece.
Yeah. That's cool. And then it becomes a one-stop shop for everybody who wants to go buy tile and they
That's
can just
right.
go pop into all the different places. Love seeing how that all comes together. And then, and now you're moving north because you guys do not want to go south. You don't like, you're not building anything south.
You know,
south
so we divide and conquer. 30. And as I mentioned, Henry, my dad's our land expert. And so he makes those determinations. And you're correct that he's not really bullish on south as much. And I think that's one of the secrets to a family business is this siphoning off of different roles. You know, it's like we all stay in our own lane.
Love that.
And so I'm not a land acquisition person. I work with what I'm given. He's very good at it. He tends to get really good locations. And, that's his prerogative as far as exactly where we go. And to your point, he's really been looking at Denton a lot recently. And I agree. I think it's a great location, but that's really been his focus. And so we've gotten four or five different tracks up there very recently. And so for the next number of years, that's, I think, all we're going to develop will be in
And
Denton.
It's right where the 35s converge, right?
Yes, exactly.
35E and 35W. So
we're developing 900,000 feet right now that we've just started recently, which is a great start. And then we have an abundance of land, I think 400 or 500 acres of industrial land up there. So it'll keep us busy for the years
That's
to come.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
You need a helicopter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Get out there and show those properties.
It's interesting, Ward, because it takes a lot of discipline because we have, you know, a good land holdings at our Austin Ranch development at 121 near the toll road. And we could develop quite a few more warehouses there. In fact, we have two that are under construction currently, but we've just made a collective decision we think there's probably a higher and better use. And so we're kind of restraining ourselves from proceeding with more industrial development there. But the temptation does get us because, you know, sometimes people even call it build-to-suit opportunities.
Right.
And it's like, geez, we have a piece of undeveloped land. We could have it 100% pre-leased with a good credit tenant. It is enticing. But we think, you know, if the land was worth, for example, 2x for, you know, if it's office or apartments, then that's the determining factor. And so the mandate going forward is to resist those temptations and to really focus on Denton. Yeah.
Very cool. And then I'm just going to throw this in, but I would say that one thing that really differentiates you guys from my perspective is you build extremely high quality real estate in all service lines, really. And I've just recently did an office deal with you guys at Cypress Waters. And
yeah, that's our trophy asset. Oh, so thank you for that. Yeah.
Very nice. But it's high quality buildings because you're long-term holders and you rarely sell. And sometimes you might, but these buildings, you're building them for maybe, you know, your son
the
might
next
be
generation, who
leasing
knows?
These buildings today.
Yeah. You know? That is our methodology. We tend to be long-term holders. It makes life easier in some ways because we don't fret so much about decisions like, are we going to sell? It's kind of almost a foregone conclusion for the most part. Just kind of rinse and repeat, keep on doing the same. And life's a little bit less chaotic and less nerve-wracking that way because there's more predictability. And part and parcel with that is long-term debt. And so at our company, we've been getting for years, we've been really long-term fixed low interest rate debt. And so that's very fortunate in the current moment we're in. So for example, my Dallas industrial portfolio, 85% of my debt is long-term fixed low interest rate debt. So it's a good moment to be long-term holders.
And you're not day trading.
Right.
For, you know, like I'll compare it to that. And that's just stressful. And a lot of these merchant developers are out there. Yeah. And right now, if they're in that situation where they had short-term construction financing and they have to go refinance and they have a vacant building, I mean, thankfully the market's pretty strong, but still, that can cause stress. But if you're in it for the long run, then you just, you stick to your principles and it's like your dollar cost averaging yeah. or whatever. And you're just like, yeah, have your plan and you stick to it and you don't sell and it's going to compound. And I think you guys,
I love that. The philosophy. It also has tax advantages, you know, and you avoid transaction costs, commissions and all such the, from
all
selling
the,
it.
All the capital gains.
There's a lot of advantages to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's enough about business per se, unless you want to reference it in these next questions. But what advice would you give to young George?
To young George, you know, I think I would say, this is going back a little bit to the spiritual, but I would say read the book of Proverbs. It's I think it's full of life wisdom that has timeless application. And it has a lot of the answers I was looking for back then. So, yeah.
I'm actually reading the Bible right now for the first time.
Good, good, good.
It's called the 1 Year Bible. Uh-huh. And so it has like some Old Testament, some New Testament, and then it has Proverbs and Psalms.
Yeah.
And it's like a 15-minute reading.
I've seen those.
Day.
Yeah. So I think that's fantastic.
I've been enjoying it.
I have a heart. I'm more sequential the way I read it. I can't mix it up that way, but
it's a little confusing sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there, but really reading it, there are also some stranger than fiction stories in there as well that is really intriguing to me. I'm a big reader, and I just started going to church to take my kids to church because I was raised that way and I was forced to go and I used to complain about it. But looking back, it was also like I appreciate that as part of my upbringing. So getting into that, I'm, you know, reading the good book, as they say. Okay. Now, what would you say is your greatest failure?
You know, my greatest failure, at work, I've been pretty fortunate. So I haven't had any calamities per se. And so I've been fortunate in that way. But I would say one that's maybe a bit of a missed opportunity, so you could call that a failure, is while we are long-term holders, and I do subscribe to that philosophy in general, I think in the recent years, it were so anomalous and there was such a peak of and such ridiculously low cap rates that we could have probably seized that opportunity a bit more effectively and taken some of our capital intensive, really old, borderline obsolescent product and sold more of that at like a 3 cap or something.
Oh, yeah.
So it was a bit of a missed moment. So I'm trying not to contradict myself. I think it's a nuance. I do love the long-term hold philosophy generally, but there's moments of time that are just really exceptional.
Yeah, like we just went through.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
2021,
yeah.
The first half.
Yep.
Cool. Okay, now I've got a list of rapid-fire questions.
Let's
here.
Let's do it.
What is your morning ritual?
You know, my emphasis in the mornings is a bit indulgent, which is that I really value sleep. And I think that I'm happy to give myself 8.5 or 9 hours because I know I perform qualitatively better throughout the day. So that's an emphasis of mine and I don't mind
sleeping
indulging.
Late. Is
I mean,
ritual.
I'm trying to be eloquent about it, you know, not too late, but like, I just know that's going to get me off on the right foot. So I indulge a bit there.
When do you wake up?
Like 7:30 to 7:45. Yeah. Right around there. Yeah.
You know, what's funny is I read a article about Trammell Crowe.
Okay.
And he took a nap every afternoon.
I've heard that. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I do that.
Yeah. Okay.
I take a nap almost every afternoon, like maybe 10 minutes, maybe 30 minutes if I'm lucky, if I have the time, but it's critical to my day. But I'm a very early riser. So I'll wake up at like 5:30 ish or something. Used to be earlier than that before COVID. But then I just hit a wall at 2 o'clock or something. And I try not to schedule meetings so I can go take the nap.
I think it's pivotal.
When I read that article, it's like, Trammell Crowe does it. Like, I now will be public about my nap taking in the afternoon because it is, it makes
sense. And I don't have much else to answer your question. I just have a typical routine in the morning. Nothing noteworthy beyond that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. What's your favorite hotel?
So that one, we have a timeshare at, or I guess they call it a fractional interest is what they call it these days, at Rancho Valencia. It's in Rancho Santa Fe, just north of San Diego. And that's my favorite hotel. It's really my favorite place in the world. The weather is just amazing. The sunsets are majestic and inspiring and rejuvenating. They have all kinds of entertainment for kids, Legoland, San Diego Zoo, SeaWorld, et cetera. The airport is the size of the city is manageable, much more than Los Angeles for me. It's just really my favorite place anywhere.
Is that like North County, San Diego?
So Rancho Santa Fe is like just north of La Jolla.
Okay.
I think it goes La Jolla, Del Mar, and then Rancho, and Torrey Pines is somewhere in there too. Yeah.
I love that part of the country.
It's gorgeous.
And I could retire there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Encinitas is a neat
little town. That's a beautiful
one.
Yeah.
I love La Jolla too. Okay. What about your favorite restaurant?
Favorite restaurant? I'll go with Hillstone. It's just so quality.
So solid.
I hadn't been there in a while, and I went a week ago, and it's just 5 stars every time.
I went there about a year ago for the first time in years.
And yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah. The other one I like is totally different, but Parigi. That's lesser known. That's a bit more of a jewel.
Where is that?
Less discovered. Right on Oak Lawn.
Parigi
with a P.
Parigi.
Spelled kind of funny, but it's exceptional.
Is
every time
Italian
I go
food?
There, it's almost like a work of art. You don't even want to touch it at first. It's a real mixture. A lot of fish, a lot of seafood there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll have to check that out. Yeah. I've never even heard of it.
Yeah.
That's
really amazing.
Right
why
I'm asking these questions right now.
That one's a find. It's good.
Well, what's a book that's worth talking about other than the Book of Proverbs?
Yeah. So I'll be a little bit more interesting or, broad, I guess. There's one called Founding Brothers that won a Pulitzer Prize by Joseph Ellis. And it's a wonderful book about the founding fathers. And, we live in interesting times. And I think a lot of people have been more reflective of the country's history in recent years as they evaluate some of the tumult. And this book was just like so good. It was so insightful. It just illustrated the fragility in the early days, how it was so improbable, but some courageous and valiant leaders leaned in and had faith and just effectuated a positive change that has residual benefit 200 plus years later.
It's really insane to think about. I will have to read that book.
Yeah.
It sounds amazing. Do you have a favorite quote?
A favorite quote.
You or know, at least a quote.
Yeah, there's
so many quotes.
There's so many good ones to go with. There's a C.S. Lewis quote that reads that, "I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." And so I've always liked that one because it's it just resonates with me, Yeah. He speaks for itself.
He like converted to Christianity later in life, I believe.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
I think he may have even been a skeptic.
He was very skeptical.
And then had a shift.
That's right. And some of his writings are just so eloquent.
Oh yeah, amazing author. Okay, I love music, so always looking to hear songs that inspire you. So if you've got one that you'd like to share.
Sure.
I can't play it. I don't think on the podcast, but I will put it in the show notes so people can click on Spotify or whatever and check it out.
So Coldplay is my favorite band. I just adore Coldplay. I've been to 3 of their concerts and we traveled, in fact, I think for 2 of them. And Chris Martin's just really a philanthropic, generous spirit with a remarkable talent. He was just made to be a musician. You can see it so innate.
Yeah.
I would go with, Clocks is one of their songs, but
Clocks.
I could probably list more than a dozen for you.
Clocks by Coldplay. That's your go-to.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're a great band. Is there a charity or a cause that you donate money and time to or?
Yes. Yeah, so we're super involved. My wife chairs a lot of events and she's on the board of Teach for America and United to Learn and the 24-Hour Club and some other ones. She's chairing an event next year for Children's Medical Center. You can't really come up with a better cause than that, I think. If anyone ever tours the facility, you're like, there's not a more legitimate cause than this one. And they do a really quality job.
I told you that my daughter Betty has type 1 diabetes and she had like this cold that's been going around that everybody like allergies or whatever. And sometimes like on occasion when she'll get a little cold, like her blood sugar will just like randomly act up, and she got ketones. And anyway, we had to go last Thursday to the ER at Children's, and I was thinking, and I never want to have to go to the ER, nor should anyone, but if you're going to go to an ER, it's just so smooth, so clean. Everyone there was so, like, the nurses were so good with her, and, you know, it's scary. She had to get an IV and all of that, and still, after 4 years of dealing with this, like, it's just scary, but it's an amazing place. So, and your wife, Lindsay, I've known since before you.
Exactly.
Because we worked together at Transwestern, mm-hmm. and she was, you know, an amazing real estate broker. Does she do brokerage anywhere?
She doesn't anymore, but she's a great salesperson. I see examples all the time. And so now her new playground is the philanthropic world. And so she's really active there.
She needs to sell me on, like, supporting this Children's Medical Center.
Exactly.
Cost, because I'm like a beneficiary of that.
Well, I'll just go ahead and say, so they have this event every year. They rent out the entire park of Six Flags, Texas. Children's Medical does. This is the event she's chairing next year with my sister. And she might have another co-host. And anyhow, but it's like there's no lines. The kids go up, and it's like incredibly short lines. And so it's just a win-win, a really fun time for a good cause.
So fun.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'll put all this stuff in the show notes so people can find it.
Yeah.
And okay. Now, if you had $100 million in a briefcase and you don't have anyone telling you what to do with it, you get to decide what to do with it. What would you invest it in and why?
You know, I would invest it in land north of Dallas. So my entire lifetime, I've just observed my dad, but also other people invest in land to the north, and it's just up and to the right. It's the darndest thing. I mean, it's just like a remarkable investment.
You just keep going because it keeps going north,
yeah, it does.
Right?
It does. And so that's a remarkable investment. On top of that, it's very low maintenance. You don't have to manage people. It's not like the stock market where you're constantly seeing volatility and, you know, ups and downs and so forth. And so there's a tangibility to it, and there's an intrinsic value there. That's a great value proposition. And so I'm very attracted to that investment profile.
Have you gotten to spend time with your dad, being the land guru that he is, to learn his ways of how he looks at sites and all that?
Yeah, so I grew up, that was kind of our pastime on the weekends growing up, was we'd go drive land. It's kind of a funny thing to do. But so I've seen his style and his approach. I don't think I've mastered it the same way he has. But I kind of know his methodology. I think part of it is, it's multifaceted, but part of it is buying at scale. Because when you buy at scale, so many investors, even institutional investors, really are looking for cash flow. And very few folks are like willing to just kind of forego the cash flow. And that creates an inefficiency that creates a discount factor. And so if you're willing to kind of tolerate that, it's really appealing.
If you look at like Ross Perot Jr. And the Alliance story, mm-hmm. that's what he basically
very similar.
Did there.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, I think it was 20 years of buying all these huge plots of land, and I'm sure lots of people thought he was crazy and didn't know what he was doing. And now
it's amazing.
Absolutely dominated in the logistics.
It's great returns
and office.
It's, you know, it creates remarkable returns. And I'm just attracted to the fact that it's the underlying value is so reliable. It's not high tech. It's not speculative. It's not experimental. It's like, this is land at a fantastic location near a dynamic and growing city. I would just sleep well at night with that kind of an investment, you know?
I said this on the last podcast, because I interviewed another developer who actually specializes in port markets, where land is, it's the same way, but it's very difficult to find land in these port markets right now. But I'm going to drop this quote again because it never gets old. But Mark Twain said, buy land, they're not making any more of it.
Exactly.
So love that. And then what's your number one thing on your bucket list or vision board, or what would you like something?
You know, I've never gone to Israel. And
okay.
I'm actually,
me neither.
I'm actually kind of provincial. I'm not an exotic traveler. In general. And so, I actually grew up traveling to some relatively exotic places, and that was just not my thing. But this one particular country has captured my imagination. I think the history is unparalleled. There's just so much going on there, and so that's for sure on my list. I think I might go there in the next year or two.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I would love to go there as well. Well, that's amazing. We're at the end of the show. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ward. This was fun.
Yeah. So, yeah. George, will you tell everyone where they can track you down if they want to ask you any follow-up questions or go lease some warehouse space from
you? Sure. Yeah. So, I live here in Dallas, and you know we have a great website with the contact information, Billingsley Company. We office in downtown in the Arts District at One Arts Plaza. So,
yeah. Right on.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ward. Appreciate you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks everybody for tuning in to this episode of Truckin' On. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, don't be shy. Please like, share, leave a 5-star review so that we can keep doing what we're doing. Stay safe out there on the road. Keep on trucking. Adios.